that song, Be Thou My Vision, was written a while after the Apostle Paul lived. But I think that if he was here tonight, he'd be in the front row, just screaming that at the top of his lungs. Perfect song. Man, perfect song for tonight. We're in Philippians. If you guys were with us the week before the retreat, you kind of were with us as we introed this series and talked a lot about just Paul's love for the Philippians and just him seeing grace in their life and the gospel change them. And tonight we get to look kind of away from the Philippians. We get to look at the Apostle Paul in a really cool way. And tonight Paul's going to do something. He's going to try to do something really big, all right, in this text. It actually is kind of it's a hefty goal he has. He actually wants to change the definition of your life. He wants to completely redefine what you are living for. He wants to change how you evaluate success and failure. And actually, the reason that Paul wants to help you redefine what you're living for is because Paul wants to give you a joy that can't be taken away from you. Paul is actually getting really personal in this section of Philippians. He talks very candidly about his future. He talks very candidly about what's going on in his life. He talks really openly about his hopes, his fears. And he does this because he really cares for these people, right? He's writing to a specific group of people in the city of Philippi, the church, these people called, we're calling them the Philippians, looking back on them. And he wants them to experience a deep kind of joy that isn't dependent on life's circumstances. A kind of joy that isn't dependent on life's circumstances, and actually a kind of joy that can't even be taken by death itself. And that's what he's trying to get. He's trying to give that vision to the Philippians. And for us today, Paul is a really important person for us to pay attention to. Even today, these 2,000 years after Paul is writing this, Paul is in prison. He's in prison and he's awaiting a trial. And this trial is going to basically determine whether Paul lives or whether Paul dies. He is a man who has had everything taken from him, but he's also a man who is marked by tremendous joy. And Paul's life should stop us in our tracks, right? Because this is a man who has nothing. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, when you look at Paul's life, he has way more joy than most of us who seemingly kind of have everything. He's a man who has nothing, whose life is marked by incredible joy. And so what's Paul's secret? How does he do this? How is he a guy who has lost everything and he's just so stinking happy? If you've read through Philippians, you know what I'm saying. Paul's going to tell us tonight his secret. And it's just kind of three things. I'm going to put them on the screen. This is kind of where we're going tonight. The first thing that Paul's going to talk about is that Christ brings meaning. He brings meaning to what seems like a meaningless world. So something about when the gospel came into Paul's life allows Paul to look past his simple circumstances that sometimes seem meaningless and seem terrible, and he looks past those. And Christ changes death from our greatest enemy into our greatest victory. And because of these two things, making Christ your life is the only pathway to true and lasting joy. That's going to be kind of where we land tonight, that making Christ your life is the only pathway to true and lasting joy. And so I just want us to jump right into the very first one, that Christ brings meaning to what seems like a meaningless world. And so if you've got a Bible, pull it out. We're going to be in Philippians 1 tonight. We're going to be reading Philippians 1, starting in verse 12. And I think this will be on the screens for you. He's talking about his circumstances, which don't seem great, and they certainly don't seem to be part of the plan, right? He's in prison. He writes this: I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Before we talk about what Paul is doing in this section, what he's actually talking about, I want to make sure you understand what he's not doing. Paul is not minimizing his suffering. He's not just kind of shoving it under the rug. He's not pretending that it's not a bad situation. No, Christianity actually takes human suffering and terrible life circumstances really seriously. You know, there's some religions in the world that they kind of gloss over it and they go, this is kind of an illusion. It's something we just need to detach ourselves from. That's not the answer of Christianity. Christianity takes human suffering seriously. And Paul's specific situation really isn't that great. It actually is kind of terrible, right? And the Philippians knew it, right? We kind of heard this story. They send Epaphras to Paul to kind of bring him this gift. Because you see, Paul's the leader, okay? Paul is essentially the architect of the greatest church planting movement that the world had ever seen, okay? He's the leader. He's kind of the guy in charge of the whole thing. And not only that, but the Apostle Paul was the most gifted evangelist the world had ever seen, and probably the most gifted evangelist the world still has ever seen. He would go into a city, he would tell people about Jesus, and many, many people would come to faith, and he would start churches where he went. He was an incredibly gifted evangelist, and his life's mission was to plant churches around the known world, and he was really, really good at it. He was really good at it. And now Paul's in prison. He's in prison. And we don't know how long he's been in prison. We don't get that from the text. But this isn't just an overnight kind of deal, like when he was in Philippi, right? You know, the story of Philippi, the earthquake came, he's there for a night. That's not what's going on here. No, he's in prison, and he's actually awaiting a trial. And it's a very real possibility that Paul is going to spend the rest of his life wasting away in prison and will be killed. And that will be the end of Paul's life. It's a very real possibility. And what the Philippians saw was that prison was destroying Paul's career. It was destroying his relationships. And in a very real way, it seemed like it was destroying his life's work. Prison was taking literally everything away from Paul. That's the way the Philippians saw it. And Paul starts to talk about this situation. He's talking about it to the Philippians. And he says this in verse 12. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. He's saying, I know it's bad, okay? It is bad, but this is what's happening. It's actually serving to advance the gospel. And he gives a few kind of things of what's happening. In verse 13, he talks about the whole imperial guard, right, has heard that I'm in chains for Christ. And what's going on? What does he mean there? Well, we talked about prison, right? It's different than it is today, right? You don't get the onesie, you don't get the food, but there's different kinds of prison. And Paul's kind of in like VIP prison, okay? And when I say VIP prison, I don't mean like you get great stuff given to you. No, I mean like you get a lot of guards, okay? There's a lot of guards. And so this kind of praetorian guard or this imperial guard they're talking about, the kind of prison that Paul is in, you would have a guard shackled to you every single hour of the day. They would do it in shifts, right? They do a 3-hour shift or something like that, and then the next guy would take his turn. And the irony of this, right, is so they put Paul in prison and kind of in like a like dehumanizing way, like you're always shackled to someone. There's no privacy, right? You have to go pee, and it's like, all right, I'm just going to hold on, dude, right? It's kind of like dehumanizing, right? That's kind of the point. It's shaming. But the irony of this is like you have a guy who shares the gospel with everyone he meets. And so what you do is you put him in prison and then you shackle people to him. And Paul's like, I don't know, I'm just telling these people about Jesus because they can't really go anywhere, right? I mean, some people are like stoning him and he's like, they're not doing, they're just kind of sitting next to me and they're like, hey, why are you in here? I don't know, Jesus, right? And so he starts telling about Jesus. And so that's one thing that's really cool is people are coming to know Jesus specifically in the guards, right? Even the guards of Caesar's own household are coming to know Jesus. And then in verse 14, we hear this too, the brothers, right? The brothers in the faith are getting emboldened because Paul's in prison. They're going out and they're sharing the gospel boldly. But then it gets kind of messy, right? You read this, that some of these people who are going out to share the gospel, they're not doing it because they love the gospel, they love Jesus, and they love Paul. No, he says that they're doing it to like inflict pain on Paul when he's in prison. It's kind of weird, right? Like, what does that mean? He says, they're doing it to inflict me in my imprisonment. And the closest thing I can think of is like this, okay? Say you have a friend who loves Taylor Swift, right? It's a guy, he loves T-Swift, okay? And he has like the, you know, Taylor Swift 1989 shirt on. He's got all of it, right? He has all the albums. He just loves T-Swift, okay? Huge fan. And she's coming to town, right? She's going to have this like show on the Pentacrest, but it's not a free show. It costs like $80. It's huge. It costs a lot of money, okay? But he's super stinking excited. And he has like front row tickets, right? He's going to the show. He's so excited. And then that night he has like bad salmon or something. And he's just like down for the count, right? Over the toilet, just puking his guts out. And he's super frustrated. He's like, I can't go to the show. And what you decide to do is you're like, I actually hate Taylor Swift. I can't stand her music. I can't stand her as a person. I just don't like anything about it. But you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy tickets and I'm going to go in the front row and I'm going to Snapchat my friend and be like, dude, I'm at the T-Swift concert. I hate it. I don't like it. But in your face, right? It's like, that's messed up. Like, that would be really genuinely messed up for you to do, even if it's like Taylor Swift. Like, that's just messed up. But that seems to be what's going on, right? These people are, they're actually sharing the same message about Jesus that Paul is sharing, but they're doing it to just kind of inflict harm to Paul. And Paul's response to this is so interesting. He just says this. He says, what then? Like, so what if this is happening? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that I rejoice. Guys, the big idea is this. Paul's joy comes from something outside of his circumstances. Paul's joy comes from outside of his circumstances. He's essentially saying that my joy is untouched by these guys. It's untouched by prison. It is untouched by the circumstances of my life. There's something in Paul that allows him to look beyond his world, beyond his life, and point to the gospel and say, my joy is actually in that. My joy is in that. And I don't want you to misunderstand what Paul's saying, okay? Because I think on first reading, you might read this and go, okay, yeah, Paul is essentially saying that when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade, right? You guys have heard that term, that phrase? He's the lemonade guy, right? Like, when life gives you lemons, you need to make lemonade. Like, I got put in prison, but you know what? The circumstances don't dictate how you feel. So what I did was I just shared the gospel with those people. And so really, the way to joy is it's all about what you do with your circumstances. That's not at all what Paul's saying. No, Paul's saying, when life gives you lemons, thank God you're not, like, in the culinary business, right? He's like, this has nothing to do with where my joy comes from. It's something other. It's something other. It's something else. It's not from his life's circumstances. Can any of you guys say that? That your joy, your happiness, the joy in your life is just untouched. There's a fly here. I'm trying to get it out. That is just untouched by the circumstances of your life. My guess is that most of you in the room can't do that, myself included. It's hard for us to do. We can't really say that. And actually, I think for most of us, if we're honest, the circumstances of our lives, they don't just kind of in some way affect or touch the joy in our life, but actually the circumstances in our life determine our joy. We have joy based off of what's going on in our life. And this is where this becomes an issue. Because experiencing joy, having joy, is so central to what it is to be human. And you guys know this, right? Like, joy is something deep inside humans. Like, we need joy. And this is what happens. If you don't have joy in your life, you'll do one of two things. You will do anything in your power to get it. You will do anything in your power to get it, or you will do anything in your power to distract yourself from the reality that you don't have it. And specifically, if the joy in your life comes from your circumstances, when the circumstances start to go bad, when your life starts to get dark, then you're going to respond in one of two ways. You're going to try to escape. You're going to try to escape from your life. You're going to actually try to drown yourself in just these kind of small, fleeting pleasures, right? You're going to seek pleasure in alcohol. You're going to try to seek pleasure in sex, in parties, in relationships, in food. And basically what you're doing here is you're trying to overshadow the lack of joy in your life by creating an artificial happiness. You're trying to create an artificial and temporary happiness to overshadow the fact that your life doesn't actually have joy. Or maybe it's not so much you drown yourself in pleasures. Maybe it's just that you kind of try to escape. You just try to kind of numb yourself from it all. And so you spend hours watching Netflix and you spend hours playing video games. Or you even in your mind begin to just enter into these fantasies about, oh, I'm going to do this in the future and I'm going to live here, and I'm going to have this kind of job, and I'm going to have this kind of hobby, and you just kind of live this kind of wanderlust idea in your head, because the reality of your life, there's no joy there. And so you just try to numb yourself from that and escape to something else. But maybe that's not what you would do. Maybe you're more calculating than that. Maybe you're someone who wants to control things. Some of you guys, you're trying desperately to control everything. You're trying to control your school grades, your relationships. You're trying to control your future family. You're trying to control what kind of career you will have. You are trying to determine and control everything that determines the outcome of your life. You're trying to hold it all. You're trying to grasp all of it in your hands. You're living your life in such a controlling way that nothing unexpected can happen because you're controlling it all. You're basically trying to ensure that you get all the things you think will make you happy. You go, I know I need this in order to have joy. And so you're desperately trying to figure out and control and maneuver everything in your life to make sure you get those things, because if you have those things, then you'll have joy. And the problem is that this doesn't work, right? This is why rock stars commit suicide. This is why CEOs are unhappy. Because no matter how much you try to escape or drown out the circumstances of your life, they will always find a way back to you. You can't drown them out. They will find you. And no matter how much you try to control the pieces of your life, you will fail. You will fail. And some part of your life will spin out of control. And if you don't take what Paul is saying seriously about joy tonight, then when that happens, when the life circumstances come back, or when things go out of control, it will crush you. It will destroy you. But Paul, he's not just trying to give you a kind of joy that's untouched by life circumstances. He's trying to give you a joy that's actually untouched even by death itself. And that's kind of the second thing Paul wants to talk about, that Christ changes death from our greatest enemy to our greatest victory, okay? And I want you to look closely at this next section with me. It's kind of dense. It's a little thick, okay? Paul didn't have the best grammar, okay? A lot of run-on sentences, but I want you guys to see what he's saying. We're going to start in verse 19 and 20. He says, yes, and I will rejoice. This is the end of 18. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. And it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not at all be ashamed, but that with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. I want to help you see what Paul's doing. I want to help you follow his logic. Okay, he's saying, yes, I will rejoice. Okay, I'm going to have joy. I will rejoice. And then the beginning of verse 9, he says, for. This word for, it just means because. Okay, he's saying, because I know something. And the thing that Paul knows is that through prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this is going to turn out for his deliverance. Now, this word deliverance, this is actually not the best translation. This word in the Greek is soterion, and it is essentially translated almost everywhere else as salvation. I think at first reading, it seems like Paul's saying, I'm going to get released from prison. And what Paul's talking about is way bigger than just being released from prison. He's talking big picture salvation, okay? This is going to work out for my salvation. And then in verse 20, he says, in a similar way, okay, it's my eager expectation and hope. I also know this, I'm sure this is going to happen, that I will not at all be ashamed. That I won't be ashamed, but that with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. Paul is confident that he won't be ashamed, and he's confident that Christ will be honored in his body, and that we get to see this glimpse into what is the thing he gets his joy from. Okay, we're starting to see a glimpse into this. And then he gives the reason, okay? Verse 21, he gives the reason that he knows God will be honored in his body, whether he lives or dies, and he says it. He says, for to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. It's one of the simplest sentences in the whole New Testament, and it's one of the most profound in the whole Bible. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. This is the very center of the heart of the Apostle Paul. If you want to get to know Paul, Philippians 1:21. for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If you want to know why Paul's so filled with joy, even when his life sucks, right? Even when he knows he might die. Like, why is Paul so confident that he won't be ashamed and that the thing he has hope and joy in can't be taken from him? The answer is because for Paul, to live is Christ and to die is gain. What are you living for? Paul says, hey, for me to live, he just gives a one-word definition. He just says, Christ. What's your word? What are you living for? He says in 21, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And then he kind of explains what he means. He says, if I'm to live in the flesh, okay, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Paul had one single overarching mission in his life. There was one reason that his heart was beating, and it was to make Jesus look beautiful to everyone around him. Whether you were a Christian or you were a pagan Roman guard, he said, I am going to live my life in such a way that Jesus looks amazing to you. Paul's life was all about Jesus, which meant that for Paul, death was gain. If you kill Paul, this is the irony of the whole thing, right? He's like, if you kill me, this is what happens. I get to be with Jesus. That is what happens if you kill Paul. He gets to be with Jesus. And this is the question you need to wrestle with tonight. Are you living for something? Is your life about something that death can take from you? Are you living for something that death can take away from you? Are you living for something? Does your joy come from something that death can take away from you? I want to read you guys a parable from Luke. It's one of the most, I think, just short and punchy parables that Jesus tells. And it's, I think, one of the most terrifying parables he tells as well. This is Luke 12. I think it's going to be on the screens. Jesus, he's talking to a group of people. There's a guy who comes up to him and he's talking about his inheritance. And so basically, there's a bunch of people who are really concerned about what kinds of things they're going to have in their life. They're very concerned about the circumstances of their life because for them, that was what brought them joy. And this is what Jesus says to them. He told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? It is possible that some of you in this room will live your life in such a way that you will more or less get all the things you think will bring you joy. You actually might live your life in such a way that you get the woman or the man you want, you get the family you want, you may get the career you desire, you may be wildly successful, but if these things are the source of your joy, then when death takes them from you, death will also steal your joy. Death will actually be your greatest enemy. And if you look all the way back to the very beginning of the story of humanity, right, we see that when sin entered the world, death entered the world, right? And if you guys were here for the talk on humanity at the beginning, you just see one after one after one, you just see, and then they died, and then he died, and then she died. And it's just, death has been reigning from the beginning, and death is and always has been the enemy of the human race. It's the great thief and destroyer of all human accomplishment and human happiness. And at the time, at the end of your life, no matter how well you have lived, no matter how far-reaching of an empire you have built for yourself, death will take it all from you. And this is where the gospel becomes so beautiful. Because when Jesus took your sin on himself on the cross, what he was doing, a big part of what he was accomplishing, was he was wrestling death, this enemy of mankind. He was wrestling it on the cross, and he conquered it, and he defeated it. And 3 days later, he rose from the dead, and he defeated death. If Jesus is your king, if Christ is your life, then death is no longer your greatest enemy. The great enemy of mankind since the very beginning, since Genesis 3, okay? The great enemy of mankind is no longer your enemy, but it's actually your greatest victory. For the Christian, death is gain. When we die, someone comes up to you in one of these school shootings and they hold a gun to your head and they say, "Do you believe in Jesus Christ?" And you say, "Yes." Bullet to the brain. Boom. You die. What happens is you will open your eyes and you will see the face of the Creator God who made you, who weaved you together in your mother's womb, who knows the hairs on your head and who loves you in a way that you could never possibly imagine. You will be able to stare into that face. If you're a Christian, death will be gain for you. If Christ is your life, then this life will be the closest thing to hell that you ever experience. If you're a Christian, this life will be the closest thing to hell that you ever experience, and death will be gain for you. But if Christ is not your life, then this life will be the closest thing to heaven that you ever experience. And death will be your greatest enemy. And it's because of this reality that Paul is trying to get us to see that making Christ our life is the path to joy, is our path to lasting, true and lasting joy. That's the third idea. Do you think about death like Paul does? Do you think about it like he does? When you think about death, do you think about it as gain? It's gain. If I get hit by a bus after this, like, I'm not suicidal, but if that happens, like, it's gain. Do you think about death that way? Because if you don't, then you probably have a different definition of life than Paul does. And if you don't, then your life is actually probably about something other than Christ. It's probably not about Christ. It's probably about something else. I want you guys to keep reading with me in verse 25. He says this. He says, "Convinced of this," meaning, okay, I've weighed my options. Okay, I know that, okay, if I'm going to live, it's going to be Christ. It's going to be fruitful labor. I'm going to continue sharing the gospel. I'm going to continue just being about Jesus. That's what my life's going to be about. But if I die, it's going to be even better. I get to see Jesus. But he's saying, okay, I'm convinced of this. These are my two options. I know that I will remain. I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. He's saying, I want to be free. I want to come to you. I want to work for your joy. And then 27, he says, "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or I'm absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel." And we could keep reading in the text, but I just want us to stop here. I just want us to focus on one thing. This has just been rattling around my head all week, and it's just this phrase, "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ." Just read it again and again. "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ." Are you living your life in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ? I've been thinking about this and trying to deal with this and trying to ask this question, like, am I living my life worthy of the gospel? And I'll bring you in a little bit into my life. This is kind of it's a hilarious story. It's kind of self-deprecating. I don't actually want to tell you guys. It's kind of embarrassing. I always ask on my birthday for, like, really expensive stuff. I don't know about you guys. I don't like trinkety things, and so I always have, like, some huge, I'm like, oh, I want this thing. It's like $1,000, right? And no one's going to give me $1,000 on my birthday, so everyone's like, all right, I guess we'll just, like, give you money, right? And so it's my birthday in September. I turn 26. Hooray for me. I have to pay for my own health insurance now. That sucks, okay? Don't ever turn 26. You feel like Billy Madison's just, like, shaking the kid. He's like, stay here. It's better, right? Like, you don't want to turn 26. It costs a lot of money, okay? But this is what happened, okay? I got a bunch of money, and I have a lot of different hobbies. I get distracted from Jesus easily, and so I'm just trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with, I got like $300. What am I going to do with this money? And I like to climb. I like to rock climb. And so I've always loved the idea of having my own ice climbing equipment. And you guys are like, you live in Iowa. And I'm like, I know. That's why it's dumb, okay? I'm dumb. Sin is dumb. But this is just how it works, okay? And so I just begin to get like fascinated with this. And I'm like researching this. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get mountaineering boots. I'm going to get crampons. I'm going to get ice picks. And it's just going to be awesome. I'm going to climb ice. You know, it's going to be great. And if this is what's true, God just began to kind of work in my heart, and he was like, hey, Dave, I kind of just want you to give that money to Veritas for this church campaign, you know? And I'm like, but I'm already giving a lot of other money because I have, like, a budget, and I'm like, actually giving a lot. And he's like, yeah, I know, but you don't really care about that money. I want you to give this money because this is, like, your stuff. You know, this is your money. This is David's fund money. That's in the budget, okay? That's my money. And, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it at all. And I was so resistant for literally like 2-3 weeks. God is just saying, hey, you should give that money. And I'm like, mm-mm, I don't want to. No, I'm not actually going to. I'm going to give you all, I'll give you more over here. I'll give you more out of Steffi's budget, right? But not mine. Like, I can't, she just spends the whole clothing budget. I just need something, right? And so, I'm wrestling with God over this. And you know what? At the end of the day, this is what was true. I really genuinely believed that me buying stinking pointy shoes and pointy things and climbing ice, like that actually was going to be my path to joy. Like I really thought that I began to think that me having these things, as silly as they are and as ridiculous as they are, that this is what's going to make me happy. And God just kind of showed me that. He goes, hey, you're actually trying to find your joy here and not in me. And so today, I mean, this isn't to glow, but I just gave the money to Veritas. I was like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to give it all. So I gave $300 to Veritas today. That's not, like, impressive. It's just what I needed to do. Because at the end of the day, like, if I even got this stuff, so I get it and I'm like, oh, I got my boots and my stuff, you know, then you know what? You know what's true? Then the joy of my Christmas break would be dependent on, do I actually get to go ice climbing or do I not? And do I get to go on a big trip? And then all of a sudden my joy is tied to what's going on in my life and in this stuff that I have. And I don't want my joy to be wrapped up in that, you know? So I choose to just look at Jesus. And I'm trying to figure out how to do this, you know, to live my life in a manner worthy of the gospel. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. And you might be sitting there and you're like, I don't even know if I'm doing it. Guys, I'm really far from this. But I'm trying. And the reason I'm trying is because Paul, he says it, man. He just says, live your life in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. And I want to ask you this question because I've been asking myself this question all week. Is Christ your all? Is he your all? Is he everything to you? Is he the definition of your life? Paul uses this term worthy, right? Like, is your life worthy of the gospel? And I think the reason we need to live worthy is because God, what God has done through the person of Jesus, right? What he has saved us from, our sins, the fact that he gives meaning to the meaninglessness of the world, the way that he transforms death from our enemy into our victory. There's this, it's just a salvation so magnificent. It's a story so incredible. It's a savior so beautiful that at the end of the day, it demands nothing less from us than our all. If you want to know what it costs to follow Jesus, the answer is and has always been everything. Everything. Anything less is simply unworthy of something and someone so great. For Paul, the reason that he breathed and the reason he was alive was for one sole purpose. It was just to make Jesus look beautiful to the world. So Christ was his life. It defined everything about him because to live for anything less, to live for anything else would actually make Jesus look really small and really unimportant to the world. And the reason I want you guys to wrestle with this is because some of you guys, you're going back to your apartments and you're going back to your dorm and you are preaching Jesus to people with your mouth. You're saying, I know Jesus. I met him. He's great. And then in your life, you are consistently communicating in an even louder way that Jesus actually isn't that great. He isn't actually that beautiful. He isn't that amazing. He isn't that satisfying. Because even though you found Jesus, your life is actually about ESPN. Or your life is actually about your relationship. Or your life is actually about your schoolwork, or your career, or your success, or the way people think about you. If you looked at my life over the past month, I have no doubt that you would walk away with a very real impression that my joy, my satisfaction, comes from having stupid, pointy things on my feet and picks in my hand and being out in the snow and ice. That those things are actually more satisfying and bring more joy than my relationship with Jesus. And I don't want anyone ever to look at my life and come to that conclusion about Jesus. Because it's not true, you know? Jesus changed my life. He's beautiful. And I want my life to look that way. Part of the reason that we need to live our lives in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ is because we need to show this world that Jesus is better. We have to show this world that Jesus is better than sex, that he's better than alcohol, that he's better than your career, that he's better than your boyfriend or your girlfriend. And guys, living for small dreams and small pleasures is not the mark of a Christian. It's not. The mark of a Christian is that you define your life completely differently than everyone around you. If you are a Christian, Christian, then it means Christ is your life. Anything less is simply unworthy of the gospel. Guys, but the beauty of the gospel, the thing I'm so excited to tell you guys tonight is that God never asks us to sacrifice our joy in order to live for his glory. He never asks us to sacrifice our joy to live for his glory. God will never, ever ask you to do that. And some of you, you think in the room tonight, you actually think that's the whole point of Christianity. You think that Christianity is sacrificing my joy, sacrificing my pleasure in order to live for God's glory. And I'm telling you very clearly, you are missing the point. Paul would completely disagree with you, okay? Ultimately, Christianity is not about us sacrificing anything, but it is about Jesus sacrificing everything. And you do not sacrifice your joy to follow Jesus. No, you find joy when you follow Jesus. And Paul is trying to show you that actually living for God's glory is the pathway to real and lasting pleasure. And this is just what I want to say, guys. If you're in the room, okay, and you're like, I kind of did the Christianity thing. I'm just kind of here checking it out. And I didn't find a lot of joy there. You know, there wasn't a lot of joy in what I experienced there. And this is what I want to say. I don't know what you experienced. I don't know what that was that you experienced, but it wasn't Jesus. You know, when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven, and you think about what is Jesus like? He's like a treasure in a field. And if you find him, you will sell everything in your life with joy to get that treasure. And so I'm saying, if you're telling me tonight, I've experienced Jesus, I kind of know that guy, he's not that great. What I'm telling you is that that wasn't Jesus. That's not him. No, if you think you found the treasure, but it's not that great, what I want to tell you tonight is to keep digging. Keep digging. When you find Jesus, you will know it. Because he will satisfy the deepest longings of your heart. Guys, if losing your career is going to take away your joy, if losing your career will take away your joy, you need a new definition for your life. Paul wants to rewrite it. He's saying, you need a new definition for your life. If losing your relationship or your relationships will take away your joy, then you need a new definition for your life. And if losing your life itself will take away your joy, you need a new definition for your life. You need to live for something different. God is offering you something better tonight. God's offering you something better and more lasting than anything this world can offer you. And if you want to find true and lasting joy, then accept Jesus as your King and as your Savior and live your entire life for his kingdom and his glory. And then when the world asks you, why do you have such joy? What is it about you? You can answer just like Paul and say, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Would you guys pray with me? Jesus, I've learned so much, God, this week, just looking at this text and looking at my life. And Jesus, I want to love you more than I do. I want to see your beauty more clearly, God. I have so much sin in my life that clouds the way that I see you. And so, Jesus, I'm just asking right now that you would be made glorious in this room tonight, God, and that when we enter into worship, we would just be able to see you clearly, and we'd be able to see that you are the most satisfying thing in this world. Jesus, would you please, God, would you please be our satisfaction? Would you be our joy? Jesus, thank you for dying on the cross. Thank you for the reality that you conquered sin and you conquered death, and now you now invite us into a kind of life that is vibrant and beautiful and amazing. And so, Jesus, make yourself glorious in this room tonight. You are the treasure in the room. There's nothing else. It's only about you. Would we be people who live just like Paul, that we would say, for us to live as Christ and to die as gain?